This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, a look at what business and education issues are on local ballots this year.
A couple of big issues at the state level and then kind of par for the course at the local level.
Whether 2 seats or 3 seats or 4 seats can make a real difference.
You know, I'd like to say that there's something big and exciting that should be drawing everyone to the ballot.
Plus, a new report breaks down the state of local news in Colorado.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, October 16th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. The Colorado Climate Center confirmed earlier this month that a 115-degree temperature from July is now officially the hottest temperature on record in the state. This comes as a new record for the state's largest hailstone was set in August, and a record for the lowest pressure reading was set in March during the bomb cyclone.
Now, here to tell us more about these records and how they are officially confirmed is Russ Schumacher. He's the director of the Colorado Climate Center at CSU and the Colorado State Climatologist. Russ, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Let's start with the temperature reading, 115 degrees in July, which was 1 degree higher than the state's previous record. Can you tell us a little bit about how you went about verifying this temperature record?
Anytime we get word that a potential record has been set in our state or any state, we convene a committee, and the first thing we want to just make sure is that it's, you know, a legitimate station and that something, you know, was not just completely wrong or they just didn't enter the number incorrectly or something like that. But then there were some interesting aspects to this particular one. So the location where this was set is that near the John Martin Reservoir in southeast Colorado between Los Animas and Lamar. It's at a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers facility there. The thermometer they're using is a bit older. It's called a thermograph, and it's kind of one of these things where you have a piece of paper on a wheel that's spinning around, and then a little arm goes up and down as the metal expands and contracts as it gets warmer and cooler, and it writes the temperature on there. The issue is that the top of the chart only goes up to 110 Fahrenheit, and so in this case, the marking went through the top, literally off the chart. Multiple observers there looked at it and said that 115 was the best estimate of what that was, but then that led us to think, well, does this thermometer actually work at these high temperatures? Does the pen start not going in the right direction if it's up off the top and things like that? And so then we wanted to do even more testing to make sure that it works right at those temperatures. So we got in touch with colleagues here at Colorado State University who have a laboratory oven, and they let us put the thermograph in the oven with a mercury thermometer that we know is well calibrated. And so we put them both in the oven and crank the temperature up, ended up getting up to about 119 in there, but we saw that the markings on this thermograph matched very closely to that calibrated thermometer, so we could confirm that it was actually operating properly at these high temperatures, which, you know, gave us then confidence that it very likely was actually 115 degrees on that day.
Let's shift from, you know, hot to cold now and talk about the record for the largest hailstone. This was set in August with a diameter of 4.83 inches and a weight of 8.5 ounces. How did you verify this before it melted?
We've had big hailstones in Colorado, probably bigger than this one before. So there's a bit of luck involved in this kind of record as well as the measurement. So somebody has to actually be there when the hailstone falls. And in this case, it was a family out near Bethune, and the hailstone fell at their house near their farm out there. And they happened to know a TV meteorologist in Colorado Springs. So they called him, and he called the National Weather Service, and they called us. And so we all started talking, and we were like, get it in a plastic bag, get it in the freezer so that it isn't melting any further so we can take as good of measurements as we can. So then we went out there the next day to make the measurements, and it certainly was bigger when it fell than when we measured it. And so these hailstone records are just always tricky like this because you want to preserve it as well as you can, but that's probably when people have a softball-sized hailstone falling on their house, the first thing they're thinking of is not, oh, I better get that and get it in
the
freezer.
Let me run outside and just grab that.
Exactly.
I'm curious what happens to the hailstone after it's measured. Like, does someone get to keep it?
Yeah, so in this case, a couple days after we were out there measuring it, a group from the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety came out, and they've got one of these cool 3D laser scanners, and so they took a 3D scan of the hailstone. So then what we can do is make 3D prints of it, and we just got some for our office that we can, you know, kind of show off and show people how big that was. But then now the hailstone is down in Boulder at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, so the researchers there can preserve it and use it in the future.
What do you make of all these extremes coming so close together, I mean, in a year?
Some of it, I think, is just coincidence that we've had some pretty extreme weather over the last year. And, you know, we always have exciting weather here in Colorado, but it's been particularly so. But, you know, the kind of thing that we track is, for temperature, for example, a single hot day in July maybe doesn't tell us all that much about climate trends and whatnot. It was a hot day, but we do keep close tabs on, you know, comparisons of hot records to cold records. And this year we've had both. We've had some hot records and some cold records, you know, at the daily scale. But in the long run, we're seeing a lot more high temperature records than we are low temperature records. And that is one signal of the, you know, long-term warming trend that we've been in here in Colorado and around the world.
Rush Schumacher is the director of the Colorado Climate Center and the Colorado State Climatologist. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
The Aurora City Clerk says around 17,000 residents received ballots containing an error. The ballots distributed by Adams County instruct voters to pick one candidate for an at-large city council seat. The problem is there are two seats up for election this year. The city and county are working with the Colorado Secretary of State's office to resolve the issue.
We have two updates from city council meetings in our listening area last night. A temporary development and demolition ban in Boulder's Federal Opportunity Zone has been lifted. Boulder City Council voted 6-1 at their meeting Tuesday to lift the ban that has been in place since December, according to the Boulder Daily Camera.
And Vail is moving forward with a workforce housing development in East Vail. The town council upheld the city's Planning and Environmental Commission's Booth Heights proposal by a 4-3 vote. The Vail Daily reports this was the last chance opponents had to stop the project, which will build 30 apartments, 19 townhomes, and 12 free market townhomes. Residents had expressed concern about construction traffic and impacts to wildlife. Triumph Development is expected to start construction in the spring.
Colorado fan favorite and Olympian Lindsey Vonn will be among six people inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. The selection committee recently announced their new inductees to be honored at a banquet in April. Vonn, a longtime Vail resident, four-time world ski champion, and Olympic medalist, is considered the winningest women's skier of all time. The Denver Post reports Vonn retired from competitive skiing earlier this year, citing injuries. She will join former Colorado Rockies general manager Bob Gebhard, track and field Olympian Alonzo Babers, Denver Pioneers coach George Gwazdecki, high school athlete Terry Miller, and Paralympian Aaron Popovich.
Between 2004 and 2019, 33 newspapers have ceased publication here in Colorado. That's according to the Colorado Media Project's new report, Local News is a Public Good. The report was released earlier this week.
The premise of the report is that local news is important and, quote, vital to democracy. And it takes a look at the status of local news here in Colorado, proposing solutions for how to ensure its continued success and support. Here to tell us more about the findings of this report is Melissa Milios-Davis, a member of the Colorado Media Project Public Policy Working Group. Welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to examine the state of local news?
The decline of local news is something that we've been acutely aware of. We've seen our local newspapers getting thinner. So we have been aware of this as an issue, but it's been something that we haven't felt particularly empowered to do anything about. And I think it's getting to the point where community members are realizing that without some types of community action and intervention, that this is a public good that is at threat of just further deterioration, and that it is important to our own civic engagement and just our ability as Coloradans to know what's going on in our communities, to start learn more about the issue and start taking some positive action for our communities.
What is the state of local news right now in Colorado today?
20 years ago, local advertising really sustained local news outlets. As our whole economy has changed as a result of technological advances, we're spending less time on traditional media. And so the ad dollars that used to subsidize the creation of civically important content, that revenue base is really diminishing. And if you look at, you know, just kind of the charts and the decline of that, especially in newspapers, you really begin to understand why so many journalists had to leave the profession, you know, between 2010 and 2018. We've lost nearly 44% of the journalists working in our state. We're down to about 570 reporters statewide, down from about just over 1,000. You know, that impacts our communities. Academic studies really show that losing access to this type of news, trustworthy, independent local news coverage, really results in less civic engagement, greater political polarization, lower voting rates, fewer candidates running for public office, and even higher costs of local government.
So let's talk about solutions. The report presents five ideas for reshaping the future of journalism in our state. Can you just briefly walk us through some of these proposals?
This is really a public-private solution we're proposing. We don't think that public funding should fully subsidize local news. We think that there should be diversified revenue because that protects the independence of local news. So all these proposals are really, how do you have public support being one slice of the revenue pie? So just want to like to start by saying that. So our first proposal is really empowering local communities and voters to raise local revenues to meet their own information needs. But we also think that that needs to be paired with our second proposal, which is to create a state level framework for something like that, because there are ways of doing this that locals are already testing out. But journalism, we feel, is such a critical industry to the just very basis of democracy. It's in the First Amendment. You know, it's the only profession in the First Amendment. And so we want to make sure that there are some protections and firewalls set up so that, you know, state and local governments don't end up having any, so that there's just no influence exerted by government funding. So number three is we think that there are a lot of local media businesses out there that are probably ripe for transitioning from commercial models, wholly commercial models, to mission-driven models. The fourth one is increasing support for local libraries and higher education institutions, community colleges and universities, to help meet basic community news and information needs. And then the fifth one is really something that the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, a lot of their priorities made it into this report, which is really optimizing government transparency for civic engagement by modernizing the ways that state and local entities make information accessible to citizens and to the news media.
Melissa Melios-Davis is a part of the Colorado Media Project Public Policy Working Group and Vice President of Strategic Communications and Informed Communities for the Gates Family Foundation. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC. This week, we've been looking at the issues on Colorado ballots this year. Today, we're going to dive into some of those issues through the lenses of business and education. We spoke with Chris Wood, managing editor of BizWest, and Erica Meltzer, the bureau chief of Chalkbeat Colorado, and asked them each to bring a list to the issues they're watching ahead of next month's election.
To start, we're going to hear how the business and education communities are talking about the statewide question Proposition CC, which has to do with the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, or TABOR. Here's BizWest's Chris Wood.
Well, I think the business community is somewhat divided. As you know, Proposition CC would enable the state to retain and spend revenues that it collects above inflation and population growth. And currently, under the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, dating back to 1992, the state has to return any excess revenues to taxpayers. But CC would allow the state to retain and spend those revenues, with a third each going to transportation, higher ed, and K-12. This measure has seen a wide range of endorsements and a wide range of opposition. If you look at the media in particular, those opposed include the Denver Post and the Gazette down in Colorado Springs. Well, those that have endorsed it include the Aurora Sentinel, the Boulder Daily Camera, the Greeley Tribune, BizWest, and the Steamboat Pilot. So it has both opposition and support among media. Among business in particular, you have some organizations like the Chambers of Commerce in Boulder and Denver, as well as the Hispanic Chamber out of Denver that have endorsed it. A number of other chambers have yet to take a position, and some might not take one at all, perhaps because their members are somewhat divided on the issue.
Can you briefly tell us some of the key arguments for and against Proposition CC?
Well, in terms of in support, a lot of supporters would say that it will create new money for higher ed and for K-12 as well as for transportation. They say that the limits in terms of what the state can spend with inflation and population growth don't go far enough, and that a lot of needs have been going unfunded in the state. Opponents say that this really will decimate the taxpayers' Bill of Rights. Voters would still be able to vote on tax increases, but this provision would go in perpetuity, so there would be no refunds to taxpayers going forward at the state level. And there's a lot of concern that it would really decimate Tabor.
And I asked Chalkbeat's Erica Meltzer how the education community was feeling about Prop CC.
Certainly, I think people are in support of it. You see people making references to it. You know, if this happens, this will be a change for the better. I don't think you see the level of support that we saw for Amendment 73. And that's because at the end of the day, the amount of money involved is not going to be at that same level. Amendment 73, if listeners might recall, was a $1.6 billion tax increase, whereas the amount of money that Prop CC will make available will really depend on what happens with the economy when you look at the projections from the legislative economists versus the economists who work for the governor's office. There's hundreds of millions of dollars in difference in the projections.
Right.
If we go into another recession, there might not be any money, extra money at all. And because of that volatility, any money that comes to school districts will be for one-time expenses. It's not something they can use to raise teacher salaries or add mental health staff. And so I'm sure the school districts would appreciate the money. They'll certainly find ways to spend it, but it's not, in that regard, it's not a game changer.
We also asked each of them about the local issues they're focusing on this year. Now, Erica told us about some of the school board elections that she'll be watching, starting with Denver, where three seats are up for grabs.
Well, Denver is an interesting election because we have no incumbents running, which just gives you this wide open race. And for many years, there's been a majority on the board that has favored a set of education reform policies that include things like close partnership with charter schools, facilitating school choice with this universal enrollment system, and sort of an aggressive accountability system that involves closing low-performing schools and either reopening them or converting them to charters. And all of these policies, they've had a mixed record of success, and there's a certain amount of community pushback. And so the question that voters are going to be deciding this November is whether we're going to continue with those policies or whether we're going to have sort of a significant shift on the board for first time in many years to a more skeptical stance towards charters and much greater reluctance to close low-performing schools. So those are some of the issues that are in play.
Okay. And I want to shift over to Adams 14. Earlier this year, the State Board of Education ordered the district to hire an external manager in part to improve the academic achievement of students there. And there seems to be some pressure on that school board.
Yeah, this is a district that has really struggled with stability. They have very high teacher turnover. They've had a lot of administrative turnover. And they've had a lot of turnover on the school board, you know, people suddenly resigning or having to resign under pressure. And by the end of the year, you're going to have four new board members on a five-member school board. So three of those are going to be elected by voters in November. And the other one is sort of a complicated issue, but there was a midterm appointment that's going to have to be taken care of as well. So we're going to see four new faces there. And the question before that board is, in some ways, just what is the role of a school board in representing the community when so much of the operation of the school district has been turned over to a private company, in large part because outside regulators from the state didn't think they could manage their own affairs. Right. So it's a fraught situation.
Definitely. Now, you've also been following the school board elections for Jefferson County, which has a union-backed majority. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and about what you expect?
Well, there used to be a much more conservative school board in Jefferson County, and there were recall elections in 2015 that made national news. It really became this sort of proxy fight for a lot of different education interests. And since then, we've had a union-backed majority on that board. I mean, there are certainly charter schools in Jefferson County. They have an open enrollment system that they launched last year. But in general, they're a little more skeptical of charters, a little more into district control, a little more mindful of what teachers might want. And so we have two open seats on that board. You're not going to see, there's not really a potential for that majority to flip, but there is this question of, will we continue to have sort of five members who all have that endorsement of the teachers union, or could there be a dissenting voice added to the board?
Chris Wood told us about some of the local elections he and Biz West are following this year.
You know, the ballot measure might be pretty sparse on a statewide basis other than CC and one other measure, but local communities are definitely weighing a number of different ballot proposals. In Loveland, for example, voters will decide whether to allow retail and medical marijuana operations. That would include dispensaries, cultivation facilities, manufacturing, and R&D. And a separate measure would tax retail marijuana sales. Loveland also is considering tax increases for public improvements, including road projects, a new branch library, and renovation and expansion of the Loveland Museum, as well as a proposal for a new community recreation and senior center. And around the area, if you, both the Pooter and Weld RE5J district in the Johnstown-Millican area have proposed tax increases to fund new school measures.
And maybe because this year feels so low-key compared to the 2020 elections that are taking up so much attention, we were wondering, how does this year's election in Colorado shape up compared to other off-year elections?
So we asked Erica and Chris if the issues they told us about are typical of the issues they see in these odd-year elections.
Yeah, they really are. You know, city council elections, of course, occur almost every year. You have some elections, but a lot of communities, especially in our region, are constantly deciding whether to allow things like marijuana sales. You always have school board elections and proposals for new bond issues for school projects. So it does seem to be pretty typical on the statewide basis. This is pretty light ballot overall, but they are definitely some very big issues with CC as well as Proposition DD, which would allow sports betting in the state's gambling towns, with those proceeds going toward water projects. So a couple of big issues at the state level, and then kind of par for the course at the local level.
And here's what Erica told us.
So school boards typically are set up so that there's sort of rotation, so that every 2 years, a certain number of seats are up.
Not everyone at once.
Yeah, not everyone at once, because you want to have some of that institutional knowledge and some of that carryover. What really varies from district to district is, so for example, Denver has a 7-seat board and there's 3 seats that are up, but that has the potential to affect the majority because of who's on the board. And so some of these elections, it really depends on the local circumstances, how significant an election is in terms of whether 2 seats or 3 seats or 4 seats can make a real difference. It depends on who's on the board, who's staying on the board, and who's running, on whether that can really shift the philosophy and overall approach that a school board takes. And one of the things that's unfortunate is that these are elections that do really matter to something that affects hundreds of thousands of children in Colorado, but often the participation is very low because people don't tune in the same way that they do to a congressional election or a presidential election.
We also posed that question about off-year elections to Kevin Balmer. He's the executive director of the Colorado Municipal League.
You know, I don't think there is anything that different. You look at the questions that are before voters, and, you know, other than in a lot of these municipalities are going to be voting on mayors and council members going forward, the issues that they're looking at are really the types of things you would expect to see: infrastructure, public safety, finance issues, and the operational aspects of municipalities that voters are often asked to weigh in on, and appropriately so. You know, I'd like to say that there's something big and exciting that, you know, should be drawing everyone to the ballot, and I guess we can talk about that at the statewide level, but on the municipal level, it's issues that are important to those municipalities and often mean trying to improve them. But it also means asking the public to weigh in. If it means taking on additional debt or increasing a tax rate, those are important local issues, but nothing like we would see in most other elections.
That was Kevin Bommer from the Colorado Municipal League, Erica Meltzer from Chalkbeat Colorado, and Chris Wood from BizWest. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll discuss the history of women's suffrage in Colorado. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. Thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to everyone who gave during our fall membership drive. Members really do make everything possible, so thank you. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.